Hey, hello. Couch Constables! Hope you're all doing well today. In case you don't know from before, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Cornbread and Crime, all one word. You can email us at cornbreadandcrime@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter under the handle at cornbreadcrime. And we definitely encourage you, if you enjoy our podcast, to please share it with your friends, your family, your dog, anyone you think might be interested in our podcast here.
I especially like the dog.
Now, Sarah, I'm not sure if you've noticed recently, but multiple DNA Doe Project cases have been moved into the research phase in this past week or two.
What does that mean?
So I suppose that, you know, the DNA Doe Project, I suppose that they identify cases that they want to cover.
Mm-hmm.
And there's different stages of the process. And I think the research phase is underway for a lot of the cases that they've undertaken. So I suspect that maybe not soon, but sooner rather than later, we'll be getting a whole bunch of new, a rash of identified people, hopefully soon.
Oh, so it's like, they discover the body, they're unidentified, and then when they investigate, it's called research?
Well, I don't know about that, in terms of how this company does it.
Oh, okay.
But they're in a new research phase, so I just think, at the end of the day, this is kind of just a bit of news, and I thought that, well, we're probably in store for a whole bunch of new does getting their names, hopefully soon.
Exciting stuff.
Definitely, yeah. So today, I will be talking about a John Doe found in Fulton County, Georgia, which, for those of you who don't know, Fulton County is the county that most of Atlanta is located in. More specifically, this John Doe was found in what is today known as College Park. So let me tell you about him. The skeletonized remains of an African-American man were discovered on Wednesday, December 27th, 1995. The remains were found in a wooded area near the intersection of Godby Road and Old National Highway. This area is south of Atlanta proper, literally just outside the perimeter, and on the southern boundary of College Park. The intersection is surrounded by shopping centers and small-scale commercial properties, and even that was still the case back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, the area was known for drug use and a local homeless population. Many of the bones were in a centralized wooded area, but probable animal activity had scattered them up to 200 feet away. Clothing and personal effects found in the vicinity of the remains include a blue plastic comb found near the skull, a size medium long-sleeved synthetic blue shirt with red, gray, green, and blue stripes, a label on the shirt lists the word favorites, and the shirt is in a tattered condition. An inside-out heavy blue coat with a gray lining was also found. The coat has no labels and is in poor condition. There were grayish, dark brown knit pants that were in worn condition. There's an illegible laundry tag, but no other tags or labels. The Fulton County Medical Examiner received the bones and made the following estimates based on the remains. They estimated that he was between 5'6 and 5'9. He was perhaps 30 to 45 years old at the time of his death. There was no evidence of trauma, so a cause and manner of death were listed as undetermined. 12 of his teeth were missing, but it isn't clear if this occurred before death or after. The remaining teeth are in relatively good repair, with no cavities or signs of dental work, like crowns, fillings, caps, or root canals. Now let's roll back the clock here to June 6th, 1979.
Okay.
And change locations to Daytona Beach, Florida. On that day, in that location, mother and daughter Diane and Tammy Hollins were seen walking together along International Speedway Boulevard, not too far from their home on Park Drive. People became worried when the 31-year-old Diane and the 14-year-old Tammy did not show up to work or school, respectively, and they were soon reported missing.
Oh, no.
Now let's jump forward 7 years to December 6th, 1986.
I'm enjoying this ride.
Yeah, it's a ride. That is one thing that the whole thing is a ride. And you'll see how it all comes together at the end.
Okay.
So on December 6th, 1986, partial remains were found in a wooded area of rural Screven County, Georgia. This county is in between the cities of Augusta and Savannah, and the county seat is Sylvania. Authorities at the time determined that the remains belonged to a petite woman who might have been between 20 and 40 years old. Fast forward to 1992.
Wait. The first body was discovered where you started. It was discovered when?
It was discovered on December 27th, 1995.
Okay, and then we jump to 1979. Mom and daughter went missing.
Yes.
Okay.
And then a set of woman's remains were found on December 6th, 1986.
Okay. And now we're in 1992.
Now we're in 1992. Year. Yes. I was 2 years old running around.
I was just a wee baby.
So in 1992, a forensic pathologist decides to take another look at the woman's remains and amends the age range to between 15 and 20 and estimates that the woman had been deceased for 1 to 8 years prior to her discovery in late 1986. Mm. And at some point, it's kind of unclear when, the age range was amended again, as her Doe profile listed the age range as 10 to 15 years old. So over time, that age range just kept going down as as the authorities kept looking at it. So now we are back in 1995 with our College Park John Doe.
Okay.
DNA testing is conducted on the John Doe, and a surprising discovery is made. Can you guess what it is?
No, I can't.
So a DNA test indicated that the John Doe may be related to the Jane Doe found in Screven County.
Bum, bum, bum.
Skip to 2013. And DNA testing finally confirms that the Screven County Jane Doe is indeed Tammy Hollins, who went missing with her mother in Daytona Beach of 1979.
Okay.
Diane Hollins is still missing to the day of this recording, but due to circumstances involved, she is presumed deceased. Diane's boyfriend at the time was a suspect in these disappearances. He had family in Screven County. He died in 2009 and always denied any knowledge about the disappearance of Diane and Tammy.
Hmm.
Another sad twist is that authorities realized that they had been very close to Tammy's remains years before her discovery in 1986. They had come to Screven County on a lead, but made one wrong turn in the vicinity of the remains.
Ugh.
Despite knowing that Diane and Tammy are related to the College Park John Doe, there has been no identification made to date of the College Park John Doe. I don't necessarily think that this John Doe's death is related to Tammy's death and Diane's disappearance. It was never specified how strong the DNA match was or whether the match was on Tammy's mother's or father's side of the family. This very well could be a close family member or a distant and unknown relative. Part of me wants to think that if it was this glaring in the 1995 or 1996 DNA test that these two does were related, that it would have been a pretty close match, right?
Yeah.
I don't know much about how that testing works. However, I also see it being very possible that this could be a more distant relation, perhaps even unknown to Tammy or Diane at the time.
That's what I'm leaning more towards. Like, I have, you know, second or third cousins on my grandmother's side.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have those two people who I do not recognize at all, who are technically related, but just so far away.
Yeah.
Just down the genetic line, but it's
they just show up on your 23andMe branch.
Exactly.
And you're like, what?
Yeah, and you're like, yeah. So that's also a very good possibility. But yeah, we all of that just to say we don't know how strong that DNA match is. I suppose there's always a chance that the test was a false positive and that there is no relation between the College Park John Doe and the Hollinses.
I guess.
Another thing brought up online is the possibility of an error in estimating the sex of the John Doe, leading some to wonder if this John Doe might be Diane herself. Allegedly, the old Namus profile, which has since been amended, indicated that the DNA confirms that this John Doe is a male, though. I think it's most likely that this John Doe is a distant relative to Tammy and Diane, and just the puzzle hasn't just been put fully together yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the winding case of the College Park John Doe.
That's interesting. Lots of time travel. I like it.
It was definitely a time journey. I hope everyone was able to keep up. You know, if need be, please go back and rewind if you need to catch up.
We should create, you know, those word cloud boards with the red string.
Yeah, just like, here's this date and here's this date.
Mm-hmm. It all leads back to... I don't know. But what do you think?
About this John Doe?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose my main theory, he was probably just a person who lived in the area, distantly related to Tammy and Diane, who just unfortunately wound up deceased at that location.
Yeah.
I don't think it was murder, because, I mean, there's no signs of it. And then again, these are also very skeletal remains.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? All right, ready for yours?
Yeah. So today I'm covering an all too familiar story, but it's definitely one that needs to be told. It's the murder of A.C. Hall.
I've heard of that.
Have you actually heard of it?
I've heard of it. I haven't like read about it though. I feel like I've heard about it though.
Yeah, probably. So I got my sources from the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project. That's actually at Emory University. They have a lot of information about different cases. The U.S. Department of Justice, their case files online. Georgia History Timeline. And the Civil Rights Library. They have a couple of articles that I took a look at. So let's set the scene for 1962.
All right.
Most of this is going to be taking place in southern Georgia in the Macon to Albany area, which is a broad range, but still, you know, yeah, southern
like,
Georgia.
Yeah, like middle southwest Georgia, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, 1962. Height of Jim Crow. On July 22nd, 1962, while bringing food to jailed protesters in the town of Camilla, Georgia, Marion King was assaulted by police officers who beat her until she was unconscious. King actually had her children with her at the time, and she was also pregnant. And as a result from the beating, she lost the baby. August 14th, 1962, Shady Grove Baptist Church was burned to the ground. September 9th, 1962, Mount Olive Baptist Church and Mount Mary Baptist Church were set on fire. September 17th, 1962, High Hopes Baptist Church is burned to the ground. September 25th, 1962, St. Matthew's Baptist Church is also burned to the ground. Now, the reason that churches were often targeted, because that's where there were voting registration, and that's where a lot of the voters went. So there was a lot of voter suppression in 1962, and all these churches were African-American churches.
Mm.
Probably should have started with that. And all this is taking place in middle Georgia, southern Georgia. How did you say it?
I just said middle and southwest Georgia.
Middle and southwest Georgia. Let's go with that. So, let's get to A.C. Hall, shall we? Setting the scene. Lots of tension. October 13th, in the early evening, Doris Hopper, a white lady, who I assume was just looking out her window, saw an unfamiliar figure exit the driver's door of her husband's car and headed down the street. She just assumed that the car was serviced earlier that day and that the man was a mechanic returning the car. When her husband said that he didn't take the car to be serviced, they both rushed out to the car and discovered that the .22 caliber pistol was missing from the glove compartment. The Hoppers called the police, and officers James Durden and Josh Brown arrived at the scene. The Hoppers claimed that an African-American man stolen their pistol, the man who Doris saw. Officers asked if she could identify the suspect, and soon all four of them were in the police car searching for this unidentified man.
He was driving around the neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They searched all around the area, including George Washington Carver Elementary School. They pulled into the driveway of the school, you know, just to search around, and in their headlights, they can see 17-year-old A.C. Hall and his friend Eloise Franklin. Doris said, "That's the man," and because she recognized him by his white shirt and build. So let's take a break from this and go to AC and Eloise.
Okay.
So, earlier in the evening, Doris claimed she saw an unidentified black male near her car. So we're jumping to AC and Eloise around 9:30 that same night. AC Hall and his friend Eloise Franklin left Middle Georgia Veterans Club in Macon, Georgia to head back to their homes. They stopped to rest at Carver Elementary School so Eloise could rest her feet. And just as they got there, started to rest, you know, just relaxing, a police car pulls into the driveway with their lights beaming at them. AC is so scared, he asks Eloise to, you know, run with him. She says no, so AC's terrified and he runs from the police. He doesn't know why they're there.
Yeah.
Many, many reasons why he would run from the police. So, Officer Brown, who's driving, stops the police car while Officer Durden yells out the window for AC to stop. When AC didn't stop, Durden fires his weapon at him, claiming that he saw AC reach into his pocket for what he thought was a gun. Durden gets out of the car and fires again. Officer Brown also joins in on the firing. Remember, this is a 17-year-old. Officer Durden then chased AC behind the school and found him collapsed under a streetlight. Durden orders Hall to sit up and put his hands in the air. AC does comply with the officer's orders until he collapses once more, and then later that night he passes away. So during the Jim Crow era, and often as we see now, police brutality against the black community often goes unchecked, where officers can continue throughout their day as if nothing happened, and there are basically no repercussions. But in a surprising move, I guess, both officers Durden and Brown were actually suspended pending investigation from the coroner, which never happened, especially during that time. On October 17th, just 4 days after AC's death, an all-white coroner's jury, they were summoned to review the actions that led up to the death. In an unsworn statement from Durden, when AC first fled the police officers, AC turned around to fire a weapon of his own, and then that's when the police officers started firing. Officer Brown, of course, supports Durden's story and said they secured the scene and called an ambulance for AC, and then they began searching for the weapon, but the weapon was not found that night. Unsurprisingly, that morning, they find, what do you know, a .22 caliber handgun near the path where AC was running the night before. However, the hoppers actually said, yeah, that's not our gun. So randomly, a random .22 caliber gun was found at the scene. The autopsy performed on AC found that he was shot in the back. The bullet traveled through his lung, spleen, and liver, exiting through his chest. Cause of death was listed as gunshot wound to the chest. At the end of the inquest, the all-white jury said in their report, remember, this is a coroner's jury, investigatory jury. AC Hall came to his death due to the gunshot wound to his chest. Gun being in the hand of the officer J.L. Durden or officer J.T. Brown, in our opinion, it was murder. So, yeah.
Okay.
In 1962, five white men said in their opinion that these police officers shot an unarmed black child and that it's murder. And they said that they should be charged. And both officers actually were arrested and able to post the $3,000 bail. However, the grand jury, those who actually, you know, indict people, they didn't want to press charges against the officers. Later, both officers are reinstated and continue their work in the police department. The day the results of the inquest came out, 3,000 people marched in Macon, many wearing black armbands to signify the death of justice in Macon. After that, there were many petitions and boycotts that took place in Macon to try to bring awareness, to bring charges against the officers, to have them suspended, One was even just to have them publicly censured, like to say, hey, this was not okay. And all of them were shot down. In a quote from the Civil Rights Cold Cases, they end the story with, all the efforts from the black community did not produce the desired results. The officers returned to duty and they were never tried for the killing of A.C. Hall. Mm. And that is the all too familiar story of the murder of A.C. Hall. So to end our podcast on a note of levity, I think that's what we need. On our last news update, we posted a picture of a Florida man trying to get through a Wendy's drive-thru, and we asked people to caption the picture, and we do have the winner. Adam, do you want to read out the winners?
The winning caption goes to Lexi and Jeremy, who sent in, and I quote, when you only get one thing of Chick-fil-A sauce, end quote. So there's our winning caption for the Florida man story.
That was excellent. You guys, thank you for submitting those. And I guess that's it for us today. Another short one.
That's it for today. Yes. Well, thank you for listening again, and hopefully we'll see you soon. Have a good night, Couch Constables.
Stay safe.
See ya.